stopping us now. We're on the move. Boom! Chakalaka!
Hello, Trailblazers fans. Welcome to the debut edition of the Rip City Report. I'm Joe Freeman of the Oregonian. He's Casey Holdall of Trailblazers.com.
Heyo.
What's up, Case?
How you doing, Joe?
I'm good, man.
You're looking sharp this morning.
Hey, I appreciate it.
Yeah.
As always, so are you.
Yeah, well,
bringing
you know,
it strong.
I knew I was going to see you this morning, and you know, I figured I would, you know,
look your best.
At least try to brush up a little bit. Exactly.
I appreciate
give an air of professional ability for this first of our podcasts.
Nice. Speaking of which, this is the first podcast of the Rip City Report, and we're going to start bringing this to you regularly, if not weekly, hopefully, but certainly every other week at worst. And, you know, this is something that I had talked about over the summer doing and something that Casey had talked about doing as well. And when we sort of cobbled our heads together, we said, let's do it together.
Yeah.
And,
why not collaborate? You know?
Yeah.
Like one guy, you know, kind of. I have my own weird thoughts that I think to myself all the time anyway, so I figure why not have someone else to be there to bounce them off of and to point out that they're strange thoughts that maybe aren't all that applicable to.
And coming from someone who knows Casey pretty well, his strange thoughts are definitely worth hearing, so that should be good. This is, again, a joint venture between the Oregonian and Trailblazers.com, and, you know, Casey and I have a unique perspective in that you know, we both travel wherever the Blazers go, so we have unique access and a unique perspective to what's going on behind the scenes, and we hope that we can offer some of those details, at least what we can, to you guys, and stimulate a little thought and a little debate, and from time to time, we certainly will veer away from the Blazers. We hope to give, you know, maybe a solid food rec every week and give you a little insight into what goes on the road, or at least what goes on for us on the road. But mostly the talk will be about the Blazers when we don't veer off subject.
Yeah, which we will do, but you know, that's the nice thing about Portland and sports is the relationship that the city has with sports in general. I feel like, be it the Timbers or the Trailblazers or the Warhawks or the Thorns or whoever, is that there's always an element outside of sports that our fans are always seem to be interested in. So
absolutely.
So we'll give you that as well. And there don't seem to be that many Trailblazers podcasts floating around there anymore. The podcast,
true.
You know, podcasts are still popular, but they have, you know, kind of dropped from their nadir. And we started doing all the live video stuff last season, and that kind of stopped any podcasting that I had been doing. But I think for anyone who's seen me, much better.
Behind the scenes.
Exactly. I was trying to think of the nicest but yet self-effacing way I could say that I'm not exactly the most handsome man in the world and better off behind the radio. But Joe, on the other hand, with his dark masculine beard and Florida State bravado is very...
This is starting to get very uncomfortable,
I was gonna say,
and I like
it. It's already getting weird, yeah.
So far, it's good.
We're 3 minutes in, and it's already getting a little pseudo-sexual and weird. So let's get moving here.
We're off to a good start.
Let's get the main Trailblazer topic. Yeah.
Casey and I just came back from the Blazers' just completed 4-game road trip. We should point out that we're recording this late Friday morning, and the Blazers just happen to be the hottest team in the NBA. They've won 8 in a row. They are off to a 10-2 start. They just swept a 4-game road trip through Boston, Toronto, Brooklyn, and Milwaukee. And sure, it wasn't filled with heavyweight opponents by any means, but when you can sweep a 4-game trip, which is the first time they've done this since, is it
2003.
January 2003. They are off to their best start since 1999, when they also started 2-2. So we're seeing a lot of history-making things right now. We're sort of in the middle of this, and we thought now was a good time to get together right before they play a back-to-back against two of the better teams in the NBA. But what we'd like to do is offer a little perspective to where the season has started. And at this point, it was interesting going through this last trip because it sort of started off kind of, let's see where this happens. We're kind of wading through, tiptoeing into the waters, if you will. And then suddenly, by the time it ended, everywhere we went, the Blazers had become one of the hottest teams and one of the hottest topics in the league. And it seems like everybody, at least a lot of national pundits, have started to weigh in.
Yeah, it was interesting to see how people outside of the market view the Trailblazers right now, because, you know, we're in it every day, and kind of, I think sometimes the things that we see from day to day, we kind of gloss over a little bit because, you know, we see them every day. But, you know, especially on an East Coast trip where you're only there once a year, so, you know, the media only has crack at guys, you know, once. It was interesting to see how those teams were reacting to the Trailblazers, and particularly from a media perspective. And you know, a lot of the questions pregame and postgame would be, you know, what do you attribute this great start to? And, you know, how have you guys been able to do this? And you know, the team has kept a real good perspective about it, too, I felt. Like, they're, mm-hmm. you know, you have to ask these guys their opinions on that stuff. They're not saying, hey, you know, we've won 8 straight and we're feeling great. You know, it's more like a... Yeah, exactly. Especially LaMarcus Aldridge, who has been, you know, he's been here longer than any of these guys, and he's seen, you know, some good starts evaporate as with the one he always brings up. It's a very applicable one, is from the lockout season where the team started out, I believe it was like
7-2 or 6-2, something.
You know, Charles Barkley is on TNT saying he thinks Trailblazers might be the best team in the league, and then, you know, you all know what happens from there. So yeah, so the team has taken a pretty a long view approach of it, which I think has been interesting. While, you know, someone like myself is kind of, you know, getting fired up like, you know, JoJo the Indian Circus Boy, and you know, but it's interesting to see their reactions to that, and the outside media from other markets, kind of trying to wrap their heads around this team and figuring out, you know, is this team as good as their record is, or is it a product of maybe some weaker competition? But like you said, Joe, you know, sweeping any road trip is, it's crazy. I mean, like, even the good teams usually drop a game somewhere along the way, because it's hard being out on the road for an extended period of time. And, you know, 4 games isn't a super long trip, but it's not a short trip either. And to come out of those games without ever slipping up to the point of where you lose a game, which is usually how it happens. I mean, when you're on the road and you're a good team, you know, you lose games because you just maybe lose a little bit of focus, or you're tired from the night before, or what have you. But the fact that this team was able to kind of keep any of that slippage from taking place is a story in and of itself, in Casey's personal opinion.
Yeah, and to give a little perspective to the Blazers' start, we dropped how it ranks historically, or when the last time the Blazers have started this well, at least. But when the Blazers started 8-2, that had happened 6 times in franchise history, and the Blazers went on to make the playoffs each of those 6 times. And 4 of those times, they ended the season with a winning record. And coming into this season, I believe the overarching kind of question about this team was, are they playoff caliber? And certainly that was their goal. They were very outstated about that this is a team that can contend for a playoff spot. That is their goal. And to put it in perspective, to get off to this start, I think, was immensely important for this particular group because of that question, because of a lot of the unknowns that surrounded this team, because it is still a fairly young team. There are a lot of new pieces, key pieces, that are playing. And so to get off to this start, I think, was huge, not only for the confidence of this team and for the belief in what Coach Terry Stotts is trying to do, but also for the fan base, and just to quiet those kind of, is this team a playoff worthy team? Because now you're not even hearing people say, is this team going to be in the playoffs? It's, how good can this team be? And I think that's an interesting narrative to kind of switch. But like you said, I have been interested by what I've seen behind the scenes, and it's, you know, it's hard to put your finger on describing exactly what it is, but there's a real quiet confidence with this team.
Absolutely.
And I think it stems a lot from Damian Lillard. That's just kind of the player he is. But I've also noticed a significant change in LaMarcus Aldridge.
Yeah.
And I feel like back during that lockout season, LaMarcus Aldridge early on was borderline giddy about the way the team had started. And he kind of felt like for the first time he was the face of the franchise and the leader of that team. And he and everybody else got swept up in that start, and they, you know, boldly were talking about how good they were and how far they could go, and there was talk about Western Conference Finals and blah, 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 blah. I haven't heard any of that at all once from any player on this team. Mo Williams is like, come talk to me after game 30. Terry Stotts is like, look, I'll know more about this team. We'll know more about what this team is really like after 20 games. Damian Lillard, his whole mantra is, let's get greedy. And they're not focusing on their last 4 wins or their previous whatever wins, or the fact that they won in Denver for the first time in a billion years, or Boston the first time in a billion years. They're focusing on the next game. And there's something about that with a young team that is quite impressive, because, you know, you hear the BS about one game at a time, and you and I have heard that way too many times already.
I got to stop asking those questions, by the way, too. That's on me.
But there's a nugget of truth to that, and I don't think any NBA player really believes that down to his heart, because the notion that the Blazers aren't looking ahead at the schedule and what lies ahead, and certainly as they were beating teams, losing teams on this trip, they were focused on this weekend ahead and playing the Bulls and playing at Oakland, and you like to see that mindset out of them.
Absolutely. And for me, one of the things is that, you know, they've obviously got off to a great start, and they're going to have some tough times, mm-hmm. you know. And I think that Damian Lillard even said after the game against the Bucks, he's like, you know, we don't have to win every game, you know. Like, we don't feel like we're going to fall apart if you know, we do lose some games. But just the fact that they're able to stack some wins right now is in and of itself really important. I mean, like, the idea of, are they a playoff team? I think we kind of view that question as more like a theoretical thing, as opposed to, well, they've got 10 wins now, mm-hmm. you know, like, they only had 33 wins last season, and obviously, you know, losing 13 games in a row to end the season kind of skews that number a bit. But I mean, you know, they're almost a third of the way to their win total from last season.
And never mind, you know, their success on the road.
Exactly.
They won 11 road games all of last year.
Exactly.
They have, what, 6 this year.
So you know, it's not, you can be happy about the start and think, you know, I think this team is a playoff team without, you know, thinking that the team is going to be the Western Conference champions. You know, there is some middle ground there between,
absolutely,
hey, this team is broke and they're going to fall off, and, man, I think this team is the best Trailblazer team since, you know, 77. So, you know, it's, and that's kind of what a winning streak does for you, though, too, is it does kind of ramp up, mm-hmm. the, not even the expectations, but just kind of the, if the Blazers had lost the fifth game of this trip and had won 4 since then, you know, I even think then people would be viewing this team differently than they are. But when you string together, you know, consecutive wins, it takes on a different feel, and, you know, it kind of, it takes on a little bit of a role. And I don't think we're there yet, but, you know, some slightly reminiscent feelings from this trip as, or at least from this winning streak, I should say, as the 13 game winning streak the team went on back in the, what was that, the 2007-08 season?
Yeah.
Yes, that must
yeah.
be 2007-08. That was my first season, actually. Yeah. So
mine, too.
Yeah. So both fresh in the mind. So, you know, it's not there yet, and this is definitely a different group of guys than that group was. But, you know, it is starting to take on a little bit of a different feel to it. And I think, you know, the play of Wesley Matthews is kind of one of the reasons for that. LaMarcus Aldridge is obviously doing some pretty interesting things himself. And the team is able to do it without Damian Lillard playing, you know, his best basketball. I mean, I don't think we've seen from Damian this season what we saw from Damian last season.
Absolutely. I'm glad you brought that up, because last year, if Damian is playing the way he's playing now, the Blazers are probably 2-6
yeah.
during this 8-game win streak. I mean, he's producing numbers, and he's making his presence felt during spurts. But we have not seen the best Damian Lillard, and certainly not the Damian Lillard that we saw last season. He's missing a ton of shots at the rim, a lot of layups. He's been really streaky. He'll hit a couple, and then he'll miss a couple. But with the roster built as it is, it doesn't matter, because you have so many weapons around him and so much shooting around him that he can, if he's not hitting, he can get the ball to Nick or Wes or, of course, LaMarcus, and Mo Williams comes off the bench to produce. And with all that said, there's not as much weight on Damian. I remember talking to him last year after one game, and he had just been, I don't know if it was his 1-for-15 performance or 1-for-14, that really, really bad game he had last year when he couldn't hit anything. But
yeah, Orlando.
Yeah, I remember talking to him after the game when kind of the scrum had cleared. And for those of you who don't know behind the scenes, so we kind of wait for these guys after games. And Damian is well known for taking his sweet time after games to kind of allow the masses to gather. And he sort of gets dressed very slowly and, you know, make sure that he looks pretty before the cameras. And then almost when the entire locker room is cleared out, he'll conduct his post-game, you know, availability. And I remember, you know, talking to everybody, kind of the masses huddling around him and speaking with him, and they kind of trickled away. And I kind of hung back to talk to him a little more. And he said, this is just, I've figured out that this is how it is. When I'm playing well, I'm going to get all the credit. and I'm going to get all the acclaim and the hype. And when I don't play well, it's my fault. And we're not going to win. And that's just what it is. Well, that strikes me now because that's not the case anymore.
Yeah.
If he can play a solid, not spectacular, or even I've seen him, obviously he's had bad games during this stretch and the Blazers have won. And I think that speaks to how much improved this team is and how much better they're built for the long run.
Absolutely. And I think they, you know, not that they maybe didn't trust each other last year, but I feel like they're trusting each other more this year to where, you know, if Damian isn't maybe having a great game, he's not forcing the issue as maybe he would have had to, or at least felt like he had to last season, which is great to see because there are so many of those other weapons. And I think that, you know, the guys are they genuinely seem to enjoy it when someone else is doing well on this.
Absolutely,
team,
yeah.
Like, especially, you know, in the locker room after the game against Brooklyn, you know, Wesley Matthews comes out and just on fire in that first quarter. And, you know, everyone was kind of busting his chops about the All-Star ballot thing after the game. And, you know, that's something where, you know, Wes takes a lot of pride in what he does. And, you know, he's always looking for anything to use as motivation. Mm-hmm. And I think his teammates are kind of picking up on that a little bit. Mm-hmm. And they, you know, they want to win
him
a little. Exactly. They want to kind of, you know, have some fun with it, but also use it as a way to be like, hey, Wes, you know,
these
guys are disrespecting you, man, and you got to come out here and do your thing. So it's just those kind of things that, you know, like I said, the locker room wasn't bad last year at all, but it just feels like it's a little bit closer this year. And I mean, that's what a winning streak will do for you.
Absolutely.
Well. It'll build that camaraderie, which is in and of itself not something that you can overlook when it comes to a winning streak, because it, you know, again, there are going to be tough times, mm-hmm. and things are going to.
This team hasn't faced adversity yet.
Exactly.
And that will
happen. Mm-hmm. Exactly. But able to, like I said, to build some wins now, to build some chemistry and some belief in each other, and to be able to win some of those games, to be like, hey, you know, even if Damian's having an off night, we can still win this game. Even if LaMarcus is having an off night, which I don't know that he's really had one yet this season, but I mean, he would say he has at least.
Yeah.
I mean, he had said that, you know, he didn't feel like he'd been playing particularly well on that trip, which, you know, just speaks to kind of where he's at in his career right now. When, you know, 20 points and 8 rebounds or 7 rebounds is not necessarily what he's looking for. So
yeah, well, you brought up the Wesley Matthews. Was that in Brooklyn or was that in Toronto? Where was that?
Well, it was in. I know it was
the next
in,
level. Where was the next level? Quote the comment from L.A.
That was in Brooklyn.
Okay.
Yeah.
So we're in the locker room, and LaMarcus is over in the corner, and he's kind of getting dressed while Wesley is answering questions from reporters, and he's kind of getting dressed, and I think it was you who asked LaMarcus about Wes because he was calling him Ballot. He was screaming across the locker room saying, "Hey, Ballot. Yeah, you go, Ballot. Keep it going, Ballot." And obviously all of this is in reference to Wesley Matthews not being included in the All-Star ballot by the NBA. And this is the same Wesley Matthews who was mad about his ESPN player ranking, who was mad at NBA 2K Live because it only has a three ball by his name, and his ranking's like 78 or 79. And I wrote about this in training camp. He spent the summer hearing from his close friends about how he's lost his edge and he's gotten soft and he's changed who he is. And so all of this feeds perfectly, like you said, into Wesley's kind of demeanor. But going back to this scene, I believe it was Casey who said something to LaMarcus and about it seems like he's been different. And LA said, well, he's playing angry because of his slight from the All-Star game. And I said, well, he always plays angry. And LA said, well, he's playing next level angry right now. And the result has been striking. Wesley is shooting 54% from the field, which is ridiculous. 54% from 3-point range. He's averaging 15.9 points, and it's got to be a career high, his 5.0 rebounds, right?
Yeah,
I mean,
no,
that's
I,
no question
it,
by
it
two, by at least
high.
Two, yeah. It's kind of reminiscent back to his second season with the Blazers. He averaged right at 15.9 points per game that season, his first season. Was it the first season with the Blazers? I think it's his first season with the Blazers, second in the NBA.
Yeah.
All the while, his defense on the perimeter has been outstanding. The Blazers, not so much directly after the game, but a night after facing Brooklyn, I can't tell you how many guys talked about his defense on Joe Johnson and how that changed around that sizzling first quarter that the Nets had and totally changed the trajectory of that game and feel of that game, which led the Blazers to that win. So the question is, can Wesley sustain this?
Yeah.
And And that's, I mean, he's, if you look at his career numbers, he's essentially a 40% three-point shooter, which is good.
It's pretty good.
It's solid.
Yeah, exactly.
Now, I've gotten into Terry Stotts with, he and I have gotten back and forth about this, because he said, you know, he points out that he's got so many three-point shooters who are so good. And my thing is, Wesley cannot keep up shooting 50% from three-point range and 54% from the field. So Terry emails me this list of the NBA leaders who are three-point shooting leaders, and there's like 15 guys who are shooting 50% or better. And so, of course, my response was, let's talk in April. But
yeah.
That notwithstanding, what Wesley is bringing to this team right now, and I should point out that for the first time in a couple of years, he's healthy.
Yeah, and that makes a difference.
And he started off relatively healthy last year, and then he hurt his hip, and everything was derailed. But if you go back to his numbers at that point, he wasn't shooting 50%, but he was playing pretty well, and he had expanded his game. And I think you're seeing what Wesley can do with this much talent around him in the Terry Stotts system.
And I think it's a couple of things there. It's interesting that his friends were kind of busting his chops about that, because and Wesley did say this was kind of the first summer that he took some
easy
time off.
Yeah.
Exactly. Like, you know, and he had a PRP injection in his ankle. He had that elbow surgery, mm-hmm, for an abutment or whatever that was called. Jeez. So, I mean, even if it wasn't, you know, by his own devices, he had to kind of step back and take it a little bit easy this.
And he said at the end of the last season that he needed to be smarter.
Yeah,
about the way he approached things.
And exactly. And so it's funny for his friends to bust his chops about that, considering like that's what he needed. You know, like, mm-hmm, he's a guy who's out practicing two times a day in the off season. It's like, Wes, you don't need that.
What are you doing?
You know? Like,
is what he should. They should
he's
be saying.
Even a guy,
yeah.
It was funny. We were in Toronto on this trip, and we're at the Raptors practice facility, or at least their practice court. And, you know, it's in a practice, and LaMarcus is sitting there, you know, on the bench with his knees wrapped, and Wes is over with the deep bench guys, you know, like the Allen Crabs and the Will Bartons. Yeah, and they're over, you know, they were running a drill where they had to shoot a three and then sprint both to the end of the court and back and then shoot another three in transition. And it kind of turned into a contest. And Wes is out there going with these guys. And LaMarcus is like, Wes, come on, man. He's like, we got a game tomorrow, man. Yeah. Like, you don't need to be out there doing that. And that's just,
that's,
you know,
Wes.
So he's getting that now, exactly. Which it's nice that he gave himself some time off this summer so he could do that.
Mm-hmm.
And just real quick about his rebounding, I mean, I haven't figured out a good way to kind of
work this into a story.
Into
me
it.
Neither,
yeah. But
yeah.
He keeps saying that, you know, his rebounding, you know, you ask Wes, what do you attribute this hot shooting to? You know,
why are you playing so damn well?
Yeah, and he keeps saying it's like it's rebounding. He's like, I'm going out in every game, and I'm focusing on rebounding right from the jump, and that's getting me into the game right away. So I don't have to hit a shot, or I don't have to get any touches offensively to already kind of be in the flow of the game, because I'm going out there saying, hey, I need to hit the glass, mm-hmm, and I need to be the guy that's going to rebound on this team. So, I mean, I don't. I think in one way it's kind of a way to kind of take some of the emphasis off the shooting, and especially, you know, when you're a guy who's on a hot streak,
you don't want to talk about it.
You don't want to be like, well, yeah, I'm shooting the ball great because I'm awesome. You know, it's a way for him to kind of bring up another part of his game that's also that he's been really good at this year. But no one's saying Wesley Matthews.
Why are you rebounding?
There's
so
no
well.
Way Wesley Matthews is going to rebound at 5.6 per game. He's going to regress eventually. You know, like there's people are saying that about his shooting, and yes, you would expect at some point in time that he's going to maybe fall back to the pack a little bit. But on the other hand, you know, and this was something I think we talked a little bit about last week, is that, you know, when a team is doing a whole bunch of things that you're expecting them to not do as well for the entire season. I believe in regression. I believe, you know, for the most part that, you know, the stats do tell a story that is somewhat predictive throughout the course of a season. But when you have a bunch of guys shooting three-pointers well, when you have a team scoring as one of the most efficient teams in the NBA, mm-hmm, at a certain point, you got to maybe step back and say, well, maybe they're just good.
Maybe
this is just what they are.
Yeah.
Yeah, maybe they're a really good three-pointers team. Maybe they are going to be one of the most efficient offensive teams in the league. Mm-hmm. You know, if it was just one or two things, then yeah, I think you maybe chalk it up to a hot run and you know, maybe just being a little bit on a roll, but
playing bad teams.
Exactly. But you know, at a certain point, you got to give them some credit. Yeah. And you got to look at it and say, well, maybe this is who they are.
Yeah. And it's funny to me, this whole notion of the Blazers being a three-point shooting team and that being a surprise, or that they're shooting too many threes. First of all, they're eighth in the NBA in attempts per game at about 24.9. So it's not as if they're – I mean, there are seven teams who are shooting and attempting more threes per game. But even more, when Terry Stotts was hired as coach, in his introductory press conference, he said, we are going to shoot a lot of threes. Yeah. This is not breaking news. And, hello, look at the roster. Nicholas Batum, Wesley Matthews, Damian Lillard, Mo Williams. These are all three-point shooters. Darrell Wright. What are they going to – is Terry Stotts going to devise a game plan for them to penetrate the lane a lot? Is that where he's going to put his focus? No, he's going to have these guys shoot. He's going to have them run around in the flow offense and tire a team out and rely on trust the pass and rely on having a movement-based offense. And then in the middle of it all, having LaMarcus Aldridge, who can score inside and out, round it all together. So, yeah, the Blazers are fourth in three-point shooting percentage. They're shooting about 42% on the year. And they're third in the NBA in makes per game at 9.9. And this is all, again, heading into the back-to-back against the Bulls and the Warriors. But that is how the roster is constructed. Of course that is what you're going to do. You're going to shoot a lot of threes. You're going to focus your offense around that because that's how the roster is built. And quite frankly, that's how the NBA game is moving. Terry Stotts... going back to training camp, and I don't have the stat in front of me right now, so I'm going to butcher this, but I remember it vividly. We were standing out in it was before the game against the Los Angeles Clippers at the Staples Center, and there was a huge media scrum because it was the first preseason game, believe it or not, for the Clippers that year, even though it was – or this year, even though it was late in the season. And someone had asked Terry about three-point shooting because apparently the Clippers are shooting more and trying to play more small ball. At least that was the narrative then. And Terry had thrown out some stat that just wowed the whole media scrum. He said, when Rick Pitino, who coached the Knicks then, right? Or was it the Celtics?
Celtics. Yeah.
When Rick Pitino came into the league, whatever year that was, late 80s, early 90s, I mean, I was born in 77, so I was young then, but maybe in high school, or maybe I wasn't that young. But anyway, when he came into the league and he took the league by storm, hucking up a bunch of threes, the amount that he attempted that year, which blew the league away and was the most by far, would have ranked 29th in the NBA last season. And what we're finding through all this analytics and through all these ridiculously deep scouting and, or excuse me, the statistic, I don't even know what to say. There's a lot of stats going on in the
stats,
league right now.
The new
there's
stats.
There's so much that you can't
player
even
tracking and things
exactly.
Like that.
Exactly. What we're finding is that the 3-point shot is not as low percentage a shot as what many thought, particularly the corner three, which is one of the highest valued shot in the league. It's that mid-range shot that is actually the worst shot in the league, which we could get into later if we want to talk about LaMarcus's mid-range game or even the Blazers' defense. But I guess the point I was trying to make is, first of all, the Blazers are built around shooting, and second of all, that's what the NBA has become. It's become a league of shooting.
Absolutely. And you know, there is a – both in the NBA and in fandom in the NBA, there's this sense that – you only shoot 3-pointers when you absolutely have to, you know, like it's a last ditch shot. You should only take it if your back's against the wall.
I would never be able to play pickup if that were allowed, because that's all I do is shoot.
Well, I haven't played a pickup basketball game in 10 years probably, so it shows what I know. But, you know, and there's always just, well, get into the paint, you know, and pound the ball inside. And yeah, and that worked when you got the guys that can do that. But when you
there
don't
aren't
have
those
it,
guys in the league
exactly,
anymore.
There's like five guys who are like, dump that ball into the post and let that guy operate. Mm-hmm. And even the guys that are good at it, guys like Dwight Howard, are not great at it anymore, you know? Like the defenses have gotten to a point where, you know, they take away those things.
And when you have Dwight Howard, Houston... they're either first or second in the league in three-point shooters attempts. In Orlando, because they want to open up the lane for that big guy.
Exactly. And they're you know, especially Houston is one of the most forward-thinking teams in the league when it comes to analytics
True.
As well.
True.
So there, it's taking a little bit of time to get rid of this notion that you should only take three-pointers if you have to, as opposed to it being a good shot. Because, you know, if you're talking about, like you said, is a three-pointer better or a... two-pointer that you take in a half step in
at the elbow. Oh, absolutely. Even worse than
so,
that.
And, I mean, and so you look at the box score and you say, well, you know, they took X amount of two-pointers and X amount of three-pointers. There's too many three-pointers to two-pointers. But if you're talking about a shot, a two-point shot that is, you know, way far out, and you're like, if your toe is on the line, that's the worst shot you can take.
Absolutely,
you know,
yeah.
Like you're depriving yourself of an extra point there. And that's why effective field goal percentage has become such an important stat in the NBA.
Particularly for Terry Stotts.
Exactly. Well, and I think you'll find more and more that among coaches in general who are looking to get a better feel of, you know, how are we really shooting? I think effective field goal percentage is, that's why you're seeing that more often, because it does paint a better picture of what your team is actually doing than field goal percentage does. And, you know,
and what effective field goal percentage does is it skews the weight based upon the percentage of the shot. And so, and three-pointers are valued more high because they are worth more points. So defensively, if and I'm not going to even try to explain this and break this down right now, but it essentially disperses weight more, and it carries weight differently for a three-point shot than a two-point shot. And so it factors all that in when you're looking at effective field goal defense or field goal percent, I guess. So and that's one of the biggest things that Terry Stotts is tried to employ. And I don't have the stat in front of me, but during the Blazers' streak, I believe they were fourth in the NBA, or maybe it was fourth in the NBA in effective field goal defense. And that is what he was focused on, because the Blazers' whole defense right now is built around stopping the three, limiting as much scoring as they can in the paint, which they are oftentimes failing miserably at, but allowing and almost daring teams to shoot mid-range because of the effective field goal defense. Mm-hmm. Stotts wants his team, the Blazers want their defense to be 14th, 15th, 16th, somewhere in there in field goal defense. But if their effective field goal defense is rated better, that's when you know that they're playing well and their record is good. Because, again, the three-point shot carries so much weight, and they want to limit that from opponents. And right now what you're seeing with the team and why they're playing so well is this is a dynamic, multifaceted, fun to watch, efficient, and potent offense. And that's not going to change. We saw spurts of this last year with an awful bench and just 5 to 6 capable players. So now, of course, when you add Darrell Wright and Mo Williams to that, it's going to get even better. The Blazers want to be who they are, which is a great offensive team, and kind of a middle-of-the-road defensive team,
yeah,
which is drastically improved from last year when they were one of the worst defensive teams. And if they can keep that formula together, and I think both of us have been on record as saying we think this is a playoff team, and we thought that in training camp, they're going to be even better than I think anyone thought.
Yeah, I think that's a big part of it is just, one, like you said, having any kind of bench to speak of whatsoever. And I think you're seeing that even having, you know, a guy in Mo Williams, having guys you can bring in off the bench that you know aren't going to lose the game for you makes an enormous difference. Mm-hmm. And you know, and the Trailblazers
mentally
are still,
as much as anything.
Yeah, exactly. And Trailblazers are still, you know, up towards the top of the league, if not the top of the league, when it comes to playing their starters. But they're still playing less than they played last year. It's a young starting unit to begin with. And they have guys this season in, like you said, Darrell Wright, Mo Williams, and Joel Freeland, actually, who can come in, and Thomas Robinson, actually, for that matter as well.
Sure.
You have four guys right there. Obviously, Joel was on the team last year, but
he's a different Joel Freeland.
Completely
now,
different,
yeah,
exactly. So even having just a little bit of pop off that bench makes an infinite amount of difference, and I think we're seeing that on this team right now. I want to talk real quick, too, since we're talking about field goal percentages, about LaMarcus Aldridge and the way that he's getting his points. And I think, you know, those who've covered the team remember last year that there was a stretch to start the season where it was like every other question was about LaMarcus Aldridge shooting mid-range jumpers. And it got to the point where I think that Terry was actually – I think he was actually getting upset about it, that people kept talking about it. And this year, LaMarcus is pretty much doing the same thing, leading the league in mid-range attempts, but he's hitting them at a good clip, which is another one of those kind of new NBA stat things where – you know, mid-range shots aren't the best shots that you can take. Obviously, you would prefer shots closer in or at the three-point line. But when you're a guy who can hit them at a good percentage, it's a good shot. You know, and that's something that Terry Stotts has said quite a bit, even when talking about trying to improve the team's effective field goal percentage and being a more efficient team is that, you know, yeah, if LaMarcus, you know, has an open shot at the mid-range, that's a good shot. You
for
know,
him.
For him, exactly. And I think a lot of times we look at some of these new stats, and especially for those of us who aren't maybe as versed in some of these things as other people are, is that we look at these stats and they're averages, you know, like the people throw out stats about, you know, NBA players shoot X percentage from the mid-range, which is why it's a bad shot. And that, you know, in the 20,000 feet, that's true. But these are individual players who have individual skills.
And strengths.
So, exactly. So just as a guy who is a good three-point shooter is him shooting a three-pointer is a good shot compared to Robin Lopez shooting a three-pointer.
LaMarcus or a mid-range.
Or a mid-range, yeah, or anything, you know, outside of the paint. LaMarcus Aldridge, when he's taking that shot in the mid-range, is a good shot because that's one of his strengths. And he's hitting at a, I think, at a 46% clip this year, which is, you know, I think you take that. And I think that, you know, it's not as a negative thing this year, whereas opposed to last year, it was like every question was about it. It was like, why aren't, you know, again, it was like, why aren't you scoring in the post? Why aren't you getting more points in the paint? It's like, yeah. Well, that's not who we are. And I think, like you said, the stopping points in the paint is the next progression for this team, or not even stopping it, but just slowing it down a little bit. I mean, you and I think I wrote this, you can get away with that in the regular season, and not that we should necessarily be looking any further ahead than the regular season at this point, but, you know, those are the kind of things that maybe you worry more about when you get to the playoffs. This team has just got to get there, you know, and if you can get there by, you know, being outscored by 15 to 20 in the paint every night, but you're hitting three-pointers, you know, I think you live with that, even though maybe as the season wears on, or maybe, like I said, once you get to the postseason, if this team is in fact able to do that, which, as you said, I agree, I believe this team is a playoff team, and I thought that from the beginning of the year. You know, maybe at that point in time it becomes more of an issue, and, you know, when teams start playing defense every single possession, which is what players always talk about, the difference is when it comes to playoffs, is that no one's taking possessions off in the playoffs as they do in the regular season.
Well, and going to LaMarcus also, I'll give him this. More than he ever has, his offense is a little more multidimensional now. You see him putting the ball on the floor and going around people. You see him going to the opposite block more. And when he does that, when he gets to the rim, when he completes that driving layup or something like that, or even just has a post up on the block, that opens up that mid-range shot. And so while that mid-range shot is usually terrible for a point guard or for a two guard because oftentimes they're, you know, being defended around a pick and roll or someone's in their grill defending them, L.A., that's his strength. And that often opens up because he opens up that shot for himself by driving to the hoop or being on the block or something like that. And so he doesn't take threes, so you can't even factor that into his percentage. You know, I'm sure Dirk Nowitzki takes a lot of mid-range jumpers too, and the rest of his shots are threes. So they're kind of interesting parallels in that regard. But
I keep waiting for LaMarcus to start taking some threes.
Yeah.
I mean, I feel like one of the reasons he doesn't is because he doesn't want to answer questions about it. You know, like I think that we saw with Myers, Leonard in the in training camp, you know, if you're a big man and even if you're asked, hey, have you considered shooting three-pointers? You say, well, yeah, you know, I've considered it. That's you're done.
Yeah.
Like, you're getting,
ball game.
You're getting raked over the coals for that one. So I think with L.A., like, he's got that shot. And obviously, you know, when you're playing with four guys who are better three-point shooters than you anyways, there's no reason to. But I'm surprised that they don't maybe run a play every now and then for him to get something from the corner. But that's my one stupid tangent.
Me personally, I want Nicholas. I want Wesley Matthews. I want Dame. I want Mo. I want Darrell. I want those guys taking threes. I don't want L.A. taking threes unless it's, you know, a desperation shot at the buzzer and he's open and he's the one. But I will take a mid-range shot from him all day as long as he sets it up and does show that aspect of going to the block or being at the elbow and driving around guys, which we've seen that added to the Stotts playbook this year. And we are seeing that. So at this point, I'm fine with L.A. taking so many mid-range shots and because he's going to make them. Yeah. I mean, that's just his game. That's who L.A. is. And if you haven't accepted who LaMarcus is by now, then you're never going to accept him. And quite frankly, I think he has gotten dramatically better from what he was 3-4 years ago. And a lot of that stems just from him becoming more comfortable with who he is as a game and accepting himself for who he is and just rolling with
it. Yeah, and I think that's something that I've thought about a lot over the years is accepting players for who they are, because, you know, especially when a team struggles, as this team has struggled, you know, in the past couple of years, you'll get people saying, you know, why aren't they doing this?
Or we need this, or we need that.
Or why doesn't Nick drive the ball more? Any number of things. And like you said, at a certain point, players are who they are. And you either accept it and you take them for their limitations, or you drive yourself crazy thinking about why they don't do the things that you think that they should be doing.
And me, as a fan of not the Blazers, but say a Florida State football or of the Boston Red Sox or something like that, I do the same thing.
Yeah.
I'm as guilty as anybody at that. EJ Manuel was maddening as a Florida State quarterback because you saw that he could do so much more and he never did.
Yes, and no one
is going to care about what I'm saying right
now,
but
Manuel, yes.
we have gone here. That's where we're at. But then you see Jameis Winston come in and do what he does and you're like, see, I told you. Well, they're different players. And EJ Manuel was a first round draft pick in the NFL and Jameis Winston's going to be a number one pick. They're different players. And I'm done talking about Florida State football. I'll stop right there.
Well, the whole Jameis Winston part, I think that is an element of it, in that when you have a team like the Trailblazers had in the early 90s that is so synonymous with the Trailblazers, with Clyde Drexler and Terry Porter and Jerome Kersey, and when you have guys like that, it really colors the franchise and the way people view it, mm-hmm. personnel-wise. So, like, you have fans who, you know, are, you know, around our age, mid-30s, who grew up in the time when the Trailblazers were really in their heyday. And I think, to a certain extent, you view a LaMarcus Aldridge and you think to yourself, well, why can't he be more like Buck Williams, you know? Or you view a, I think, kind of less in this situation, but a Damian Lillard, why can't you be more of a distributor like a Terry Porter was, you know? Mm-hmm. And it's like, well,
he's not Terry Porter.
That's not him. Yeah, exactly.
And frankly, he's better than Terry Porter. And he's going to be better than Terry Porter.
That's why that example wasn't exactly real applicable, because I don't hear many people saying, well, boy, why can't
Damian be more like TP?
Yeah, exactly. But just the notion that when you have a franchise that so many of the emotions are tied up in, you know, about five or six players, it changes kind of the way people view the rest of the franchise. And the way to kind of negate that is for a team to come out and have their own success. And I think that, you know, the Trailblazers, this current iteration, are able to do that. You know, I think you'll see the next generation of Trailblazers fans be like, why doesn't our power forward shoot more mid-range jumpers? Why are they trying to get in the paint so often and so on and so forth? Why are they shooting more three-pointers? You know, like, there will be a time when Trailblazer fans are thinking to themselves, dang it, this team needs to shoot more threes, and all of these two-point shots are
boring. This is boring.
It's a run and gun. Yeah. So we'll get there eventually, or they will if one of these teams can have some kind of success. Yeah. And you didn't see it as much with the early 2000s team, because so much of their kind of everything with that team is wrapped up in the personalities of that team, not so much the way they play. Because, I mean, so case in point, I think if Rasheed Wallace had been a more likable person for fans, you would have seen, I think, more of an acceptance of LaMarcus Aldridge earlier in his career, because they have
very similar characteristics,
play on the court. And if everything with Rasheed hadn't been tied up in CTC and getting thrown out of games, mm-hmm. then I think you would have maybe seen
more appreciation.
Yeah, exactly. And that's not to say that LaMarcus didn't have things he needed to improve upon, because he did, and he has.
Yeah.
But I think that when you have a fan base that is as knowledgeable about the past as the Trailblazers fans are, those guys live in that shadow a bit. Exactly.
Yeah. Hmm. And, you know, one thing that we should point out here with LaMarcus is, his game notwithstanding, is we've heard so much from him over the years, going back to that lockout year, about how he wanted to be a better leader, about how he needed to be a better leader, and all of that stuff that goes with that. And I really think, for the first time in his career, he is a better leader. And we are seeing
Absolutely.
Him exhibit leadership skills that we've never seen. And it started in training camp. I remember multiple guys talking about they had seen a different look in LaMarcus's eyes, a different focus, and genuinely, legitimately, realistically, not just for the look of it, he's talking more, he's directing more, he's in guys' ears at practices, at games, at shoot-arounds, in film reviews, in post-game locker rooms in the exhibition season in Boise. He's praising the play of the unheralded Joel Freeland, setting the tone and being in front of what we have come to see has become a solid role player for the Blazers and Joel. And you can't underestimate what that means for a team when their best player, their biggest, their most consistent player, their all-star, is also at what has been at this point one of their best leaders. And to me, LaMarcus has evolved into one of the most consistent, dependable players in the NBA. But his growth as a leader and his growth at that sort of things, that sort of thing, is where he's made his biggest strides and where right now he's making his best impact. Because like we talked about when we first started this podcast, LaMarcus hasn't gotten carried away with this hot start. Yeah, whereas exactly. In the past, I think he would. And you talk to him and he's like, it's early. And he's not getting carried away with it. And it's true. It is early. The Blazers have beaten 8 teams with losing records. Phoenix now has a losing record. At the time, they had a winning record, so they were 2-2 against teams with winning records. As it stands right now, I believe, the Blazers have 1 win against a team with a winning record. Now, it's a good one. They're the only team to beat the Spurs. But so you have to put all of this in perspective, and you can't erase their 10-2 record and what they're doing right now. And you can't fault them for playing the schedule that they have. That's all they can do. But you like the mindset of LaMarcus and those guys for saying, we're living in the moment. We're not getting carried away with this. And it starts with LA and his leadership, and that trickles around the locker room. And I think some of that goes back to that cool and confident demeanor I talked about a while ago.
Absolutely. A couple things about that. One, LaMarcus, I completely agree, and he's had a different mentality about him. And in the past, he's been a guy who says, you know, I let my play do the talking for itself, you know, like, and I'm more of a quiet leader who, you know,
leads by example.
Exactly. I lead by example. I work hard in practice. I expect that means the guys will see that, and they'll work hard in practice as well. And that's changed for him. You know, he's gotten to the point now where he's not so much saying, well, you guys are just going to have to kind of get in where you fit in behind me because I'm doing what I'm doing. He like you said, Joe, he is more in guys' ears. He's taking more of that role on the court of pumping guys up and kind of letting them know mm-hmm. when they need to do something differently. And that's been helpful for this team. And I was just trying to pull this up. Here it is. One thing I will say as well about the record, they have beaten, you know, like you said, not exactly the some of the greatest opponents yet, but it's not like last year where, you know, when they did get off to a good start, they're winning, you know, like 1-point games.
Yeah.
You know, the Trailblazers right now, their point differential is plus 5.7, which is 6th best in the NBA. And a lot of people who follow advanced stats will tell you that point differential is actually a better representation of how good of a team you are than your win-loss record, or it's better at predicting your wins in the future than your win-loss record does. So the fact that they're able to have gotten these victories against, you know, some teams that aren't great, but they're not winning, you know, 2-point games against the Bucks. You know, they're winning a 9-point game against the Bucks.
They're not going to triple overtime in Cleveland
to beat a bad Cleveland team. They're beating those teams. They're not boat racing them or anything, but they're beating teams handily. They're coming out, particularly in the third quarter, which is something we'll have to look into a little bit here, maybe at our next podcast, just about the changes, or not so much the changes, but what's the word I'm looking for, Joe? When you do something after the half, when you look at something
and adjustments.
There you go.
Coaching.
The coaching. Exactly. But particularly the adjustments that they seem to be making at halftime mm-hmm. to come out in third quarters and really play well and kind of change the dynamic of games, which is something I think we saw in Brooklyn.
Yeah.
And particularly it was defensive where, you know, they got into the half and they're like, hey, we need to do X, Y, and Z to kind of slow these guys down. They did. And they locked it down in that second half against Brooklyn. So
I want to go back to this to boat racing. I've been hearing this is blowing up lately, and I love it. Where the hell does that come from?
See, I thought I was more hearkening back to days of yore. I mean,
Because I've been hearing people, I've heard it from multiple different things that I listen to people talk. And maybe it's a lot about Florida State because they just bust suckers right now. They kill them, but. Where do you have any idea?
The boat,
like when you just crush suckers and it's boat racing. Like, what is that?
I think it comes from the idea that, and I only know this because where I lived in Eugene was on the mill race, mm-hmm. and they used to have a tradition. And the mill race, for those who don't know, is a winding waterway, man-made waterway that they used to run logs through to get them to the river,
wherever they go. Yeah,
and so I think the origin of the phrase is that. When you want to disrespect someone or you want to do something mean to them, you throw them in to the race, to the water. Yeah. So like if you were going to get mill raced, and they used to do that at U of O, I think after like Civil War games, you know, whichever team lost, if you were in a fraternity and, you know, the same fraternity was at Oregon State, you know, whoever lost that game, you'd go back to the mill race and you toss that fool in. So I think that's the origin
it is?
Of it.
Okay.
I mean, I'm not
because I've been hearing it so
sure
much lately, and I love it.
It is a
you're boat racing suckers. Like I don't know what I don't get it, but I like it. I don't know why.
I think that is, and I think it's a nice phrase too. It's nicer than, you know, I was trying to think of a non-vulgar way to say beating up on a team because typically
mutilating, destroying.
If we weren't recording this for the public, I would have said something.
Oh, I would have been far vulgar
yeah, exactly.
than that. Yeah.
So, but boat race is a
okay,
nice.
I like it.
You know, and it's kind of like I said, it harkens back to days of yore.
Days of yore.
And reminds you of simpler times when you know,
okay,
men were men and
children were children.
I don't know what the rest of that phrase goes. Actually,
you know what?
I like all men, by the way, too. Even those of you who others might consider men, you're all men to me. You're all heroes.
I won't even touch that.
Yeah,
because I don't like all men, and I don't like all of you. But yeah,
and
okay.
I'm lying too. Yeah, you know me more.
Yeah, wait,
than you.
There hasn't been any bitter Casey in this whole thing.
I was thinking maybe we would do a bitter Casey segment one of these days.
Oh, that would be fantastic.
I don't really want to. Do we want to put more hate into the world, Joe? Because, I mean, like, I feel like I'm already emanating it pretty well.
This can be your sanctuary of love and peace.
Yeah,
and
yeah,
no,
we'll,
Bitter
well,
Casey will surface at some point. Well, I mean, it'll...
Maybe not on a win streak. You know, if we drop three straight...
Then we'll get into the PDC
exactly,
and
when, you know,
taxes.
When I start sweating and,
yeah.
you know, like...
Gripping,
really,
yeah.
Yeah, my back starts to tighten up and... Feel like I can't breathe, and yeah, that's all great stuff.
Okay,
but seems like a good segue maybe to some of our non-basketball topics.
We'll start to wrap things up here. I don't know how long we are, but I think we've covered a lot of things, and I think what we want to do every week is Casey and I like to go out and explore all that Portland has to offer. Casey's a native Oregonian, and I've been here since almost 20 years.
Native
true
Oregonian.
Sacramento.
I was born in Alaska. Oh, no, please, come on. Don't tie me to Sacramento.
You were born in Alaska?
I was born in Alaska.
Really?
Alaska. I'm an Army, or Army. I'm an Air Force baby.
I did not know that.
Yeah.
I knew that you lived in Sacramento for quite a while.
Both of my parents lived in Oregon.
Okay.
They met in high school, long since divorced. My dad was in the Air Force. Stationed in Fairbanks, Alaska.
Gotcha.
I was born in Fairbanks, Alaska. Lived there for, I guess, maybe 9 months to a year.
Then that's about all you need to live
exactly.
there.
Exactly. Well, and I don't recall any of it. I haven't been back since, which, you know, I feel like...
I've been to Fairbanks, Alaska.
I feel like I need to get back, or even to Alaska. I feel like I need to get to Alaska one of these days to kind of... to connect with my roots.
Sure.
So, yes, I'm not a native Oregonian,
okay,
but
well,
I've lived in Oregon for the majority of my life.
Okay.
I am a third or fourth generation Oregon, so even though... I was living out of the state at the time.
You were
I had
in
no
your
control
heart,
over
in Oregon,
exactly.
Yes.
If I would have gotten to choose, I would have been born in Dundee, Oregon. But.
There you go. So anyway, the point being is that we'd like to offer up maybe a food rec of the week and give props to places that we'd like to go. And Casey and I are both huge proponents of the Big Egg. It's a food cart over on the Mississippi Food Cart.
Mississippi Food Cart.
Just right by Prost, the tavern there, and. Their breakfast wrap is stupid good.
I've tried to kind of couch the statement a little bit because a part of me
doesn't want it to get too nuts.
Well, not even that, but it's just, you know, I am of the opinion that the Big Egg might be the best breakfast in Portland. And I know there's probably some Screen Door fans out there who would disagree.
Just destroy, yeah.
And I think, you know, they've got a pretty
good point.
A legit argument for sure. And for me, you know, part of breakfast is sitting down in a diner and having coffee and, you know, maybe looking over a local free magazine or
the Oregonian.
The Oregonian. I wanted to wait for you to jump in on that.
Appreciate that.
So I just wanted to bust a little chops there. So part of me doesn't want to say that the Big Egg is the best breakfast in Oregon, but like Joe said, their breakfast wrap at the Big Egg, there's a reason why it sells out every day by like 10 o'clock. I was going to go get one yesterday.
Huh.
And
I thought about it.
I made the mistake of not leaving my house till 11. I was driving and I was not looking at my phone while I was driving, of course, but
wink, wink.
In one way or another, I found out that they had said that they were
ordering out
for breakfast wraps for the day, which was a real bummer. So I had to go to Big Ass Sandwich, which they also have now
is that there now?
At the food carts there in Mississippi, which is good for sure. And I know the folks that own Big Ass and they're very nice people, and it's a very good sandwich, but it's not the Big Egg breakfast wrap by any stretch of the imagination. So,
man,
check it out.
This is how much.
And you're going to have to wait in line, too. Don't make the mistake that I made the first time I went there. My wife and I went to the cart. We ordered two wraps, and it's going to be 45 minutes. And I was incredulous. I was like, poof, ugh. I'm not waiting 45 minutes for a wrap.
There's a little bitter, whatever. Casey. There is a little bitter, Casey.
So we tried to go to another cart, and I was like, you know, there's nothing else here. So I'll just, fine, I'll wait 45 minutes for your stupid breakfast wrap.
And Bonnie, meanwhile, is like, I have to put up with and listen to him for the next 45 minutes.
She's got her head towards the ground, and she's trying to kind of stand towards other people to make it look like maybe she's come with them and not with me. So I was like, fine, we'll wait. We'll just get coffee, and you can give me your dumb breakfast wrap, and I'll wait 45 minutes for it, you pretentious jerks. No.
Worth it.
It was the best decision I've made culinary-wise in some time waiting for it.
Fortunately, Alana and I had been warned that you might have to wait. Yes. So when we went, I brought my Oregonian. I brought my own vanilla latte to drink. The first time we went, we walked down somewhere down the street to get, I can't remember what the name of the place is. It's that Fresh Pot.
Fresh Pot, yes.
Got a latte there, came back, and then enjoyed it there. Every now and then, we'll stumble down there, and we will see you and Bonnie unplanned. You guys are there eating as well.
We're regular fixtures. But one thing I should mention, they do not take cards.
So
you need to bring cash with you. They have the cash.
They have an ATM. But nobody wants to pay $8 to get $10 out.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And that's another thing where typically, if the food wasn't so good, I would was at the counter at the time, I would read them the riot act about, hey, you can get one of these square card readers and
make it happen.
No skin off of your nose to take cards these days. But for the quality,
they're really nice people, too.
And they're very nice people, exactly. And the other thing I found from traveling is that a lot of places don't take cards, actually. So we're lucky in Portland in some respects, especially in New York City. You try to go to a restaurant with a card in New York City.
I've never had any trouble.
In the parlance of the city, forget about it, because that is not going to happen, at least for me. Every time I try to go somewhere in New York City, a restaurant that's like an established restaurant that I just assume they're going to take cards.
Suck it.
They don't take cards.
Huh.
Exactly. Well, I guess the ATM's right there.
I'm going to knock on wood, because I have a card everywhere, and I've never had any trouble.
I have trouble sometimes.
Okay. Another thing we were thinking about doing is going over on the road. Maybe every now and then we'll watch a movie or two while we're killing the time. So we'll end this with a couple of movies that we watched during this last trip. What caught your fancy?
I watched Place Beyond the Pines, is I believe what it's called. As we're getting weird.
Yeah, it's like someone's trying to attack us.
Yeah,
I don't know if
studio.
That's audio.
We haven't even posted this thing yet, and people are already banging down the door trying to get it over. So,
or maybe they're trying to give us
props. Or to get in. Yes, exactly. Yes,
they want to be a part of the revolution.
I really just displayed kind of where my mind goes when it comes to those things by assuming that it was because we were doing terrible.
Fortunately, my positivity will balance out your negativity, we'll have an even keeled podcast going forward.
Exactly. So a little something for everyone. But like I said, I watched Place Beyond the Pines with Ryan Gosling and that face man guy.
Face man?
Handsome looking fella. He's in a lot of... Bradley Cooper.
Oh,
there you go.
Yeah. Weren't those two guys the contenders for Sexiest Man Alive a couple years ago? Well, and Cooper beat out the...
Did they?
Ryan Gosling?
I think the guy who won it this year was Adam Levine, and all I keep seeing is how people are like, he's a skinny twerp and there's no way he's the Sexiest Man Alive.
Which,
again, I'm glad that we're getting to the
root of all
to the root of the we're bringing the podcast back to where I'm complimenting the way you look, Joe. Which, you know, I thought was a decent movie. It wore on a little bit. The first part I thought was definitely better than the second part. Without giving anything away too much, I have movies where plot twists, but just like coincidences in regards to things that happen later on in life you know, it's like it's kind of a tried and true plot device that I don't really care for a whole lot. I also tried to watch another Ryan Gosling movie, Only God Forgives, which is supposedly an ultra-violent tour de force, but the totally non-pirated version that I had did not have subtitles. It's a movie based in Thailand. It didn't have Thai subtitles. So I watched the first 10 minutes of it thinking, well, you know, because sometimes they don't subtitle movies if there's only going to be a little bit of it. And, you know, you're just kind of supposed to figure out what they're talking about, which I like. That was not the case when it comes to Only God Forgives. There was extended periods of time where they're speaking a language I didn't understand. And at a certain point, I'm probably not going to get a whole lot out of this.
You know, that's interesting. I also stumbled upon a Ryan Gosling movie during my treks. Yeah. There was one of my flights. I got upgraded to first class. And so I had the DirecTV in the headset kind of thing. And I caught Gangster Squad.
Which I've heard is just miserable.
I wish that I hadn't. Here's the deal. There were other movies I would have preferred. Django Unchained was there, which is awesome.
Kind of maybe a difficult movie to watch when you're sitting next to someone.
I don't care. I would watch it. It's my space.
They look over there and they're like, oh, what is this guy doing?
Well, but it's on the DirecTV. It's not on my laptop or my iPad. So yeah, I'm not like trying
enough.
To. I mean,
true
it's,
enough.
You know. So, yeah, I mean, we're talking Sean Penn, Ryan Gosling, Emma Stone. I mean, come on. Josh Brolin. And it's gangsters. It's that era of the kind of, it wasn't Bugsy Siegel, but it had that vibe. And it was not good.
Yeah.
It was highly disappointing. You wanted it to be so much better than it was, and it just didn't want to deliver for you.
Yeah, a review I read of that, and I don't remember exactly what it was, but the gist of it was, Gangster Squad seems like a movie that they created just so Sean Penn could say, yeah, the Gangster Squad scene, yeah.
Yeah.
You know, like in that old gangster
voice.
I think
yeah.
It's one of those things where it's like, maybe you get the script and, you know, you read through it and you're like, oh, this is okay.
They're going to pay me
like,
for
oh,
this.
Oh, but Josh Brolin's going to be in it.
Yeah.
And Sean
Emma
Penn's
Stone,
gonna be in it.
Yeah.
Well, okay. You know, how could we make that bad of a movie? And
turns out they did.
Yeah. Well, yeah. And there was, just real quick on that, there was a string of movies and I didn't see any of them, but there were like two movies that came out at the same time that were both like clip show comedy movies that were like throwback to that Kentucky Fried movie.
Oh, yeah,
or whatever.
And
they had tons of like, it was like
Mars Attacks kind of
asked,
thing.
Well, no, not even like
over the top.
Well, it wasn't so much that. It was that like the actual plot wasn't so much a plot as it was like chopped up bits of like just
scenes.
Like vulgar,
yeah.
Like over the top, like raunchy comedy things.
Huh.
But it was made with like A-listers, like backwards and forwards. And it's like, I think at some point in time, and maybe, you know, Hollywood is just taking itself as seriously as it used to, where they're like, hey, who cares? We're going to make some dogs. If you're going to give me $3 million and
give it
you know,
to me, I'll take
we're
it.
Going to be able to go to the rap party and get wasted. All right, sure. Let's do it. I got a weekend to knock out.
Speaking of getting wasted, another movie I came across, and this is the last one, and we'll let you guys go, because I also did stumble upon The Dark Knight Rises during one of my hotel stays. We don't even need to talk about that, because it's outstanding. Maybe you disagree,
no,
but
absolutely.
I agree. Yeah. But there's this really weird movie I had never heard of, and it's the second time that it's come on in a hotel room, kind of after a game, and I couldn't fall asleep, so I was flipping through the channels. Project X, have you heard or seen about this? It's all these high school kids,
yeah,
and
yeah.
It's like kind of like a Blair Witch, like there's
sure.
a guy running
yeah.
around with cameras, and these guys kind of talk their buddy into having a birthday party, and he's a dork at the school,
yeah.
and he gets
mm-hmm.
beat up and picked on and all that stuff, and they spread the word through everywhere you could possibly imagine, and they throw the most ridiculous, uncanny rager you've ever seen with a big, like, bouncy house and fireworks and a DJ up on a balcony that's kicking beats through everyone. I mean, there's thousands of kids there. Anyway, it's weird because it's not a good movie. It's by no means is it good. But there's something about it where you just can't stop watching the train wreck, if
sure.
you know what I mean. And that's what happens. I don't even care. Spoiler alert. It's a bad movie. None of you guys are going to watch it. But they end up setting the neighborhood on fire, and a guy rolls through with a flame or a blowtorch kind of flamethrower thing, and don't watch it.
Yeah.
And
well,
I'd tell myself not to watch it next time. Can you text me that or something on the road?
Sure.
Maybe.
Well,
I don't know.
I'm of the opinion that you got to, especially when you're traveling, you got to rejigger your ideas of like
threshold.
What,
yeah,
yeah, exactly. Because sometimes.
Yeah, take
you know,
what you
like,
can get.
Exactly. You, if. You know I'm going to be able to burn 2 hours by watching this. It's like, I'll watch pretty much whatever it is. True. As long as it's not just like offensively terrible.
Yeah. And it was, I mean, there were some qualities. Yeah, there were attractive ladies that I enjoyed watching. And
see, I feel that way, and again, we probably should wrap this up. I feel that way about the about the most recent Hobbit movie. Not the one that's coming out soon,
yeah.
But the one before that. It got panned by reviewers. The biggest complaint being that, you know, it's a 150-page book, and they're stretching it out into three movies, which I completely agree is Bush League, and they shouldn't have done it, and they should have made it in two movies at the most. So I didn't watch it. And so I was on it was one of the preseason trips where I was like, well, you know, I'll watch The Hobbit. And it was enjoyable, you know? Good. Like, I enjoyed watching it. And it wasn't the best movie ever, and it certainly, you know, again, they probably could have sped up through some parts, but
end of the
day,
it.
I was like, hey, you know, I just spent 2.5 hours, and I
moderately
was
entertained. Titillated.
Exactly. Okay. So, and this is coming from someone who poo-poos everything. Just be open to more things, folks.
Okay.
Well, don't let some jerk reviewer tell you to not watch something.
And on that note, if you have made it this far through this, congratulations. We appreciate it. We will be coming back to you soon with more titillating Blazers talk, yes, and a little bit of food and movie talk as well. And who knows what will surface in the days and weeks ahead. But he is Casey Holdall with Trailblazers.com. I am Joe Freeman with The Oregonian. We'll talk to you next time.
Thanks, everybody.
And once again, we can say it's a great day to be a Blazer. And has there ever been a better day to be a Blazer? Unbelievable.